everyone. Welcome back to the Turbo Time podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, the managing editor of Turbo Machinery International. And today we are talking about pumping CO2 with MythBusters Klaus Brunn and Rainer Kurtz. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me again. I'm really looking forward to this discussion today.
Yeah, and thanks again for allowing us to talk about this really important topic. So I'm looking forward to it.
So am I. So in part one of this episode, we'll be talking about the process of pumping CO2, how it plays into the hydrogen discussion and how it's different from hydrogen. But let's kind of back up and start at the beginning. So why are we even discussing carbon dioxide in terms of a sustainable future?
Well, thank you for bringing this up. Basically, when you look at the sustainable decarbonized energy economy, there's various sources of energy, electricity that are available. And if you look at the background of where we are in the world, about somewhere around 70 to 80% of all energy that's being produced currently in the world is based on fossil fuels. And especially if you look at electric energy on the worldwide basis, about 80% of all stationary produced carbon dioxide in the world comes from electric power plants. So that kind of puts it into perspective that we cannot rely in the future on things like hydrogen or just the wind and solar and hydro as providing us with the electricity. We can't just get rid of 80% of all of our power generation all at once. We're going to be living with fossil fuel for the next 50 or more years until we can slowly possibly transition out of that. That really means we have to do something about the carbon, the CO2, that these plants are emitting. And that's why we really need to be talking about CO2, because carbon dioxide needs to be separated and sequestered from these power plants and needs to be put somewhere into some kind of long-term storage. That brings up then some technical challenges, and that's what we're going to address in more detail, which is what do you do with the CO2? How do you transport it? So you've mentioned pumping, but it's really compression and pumping, which depends on where you're operating. It's either one of those. But fundamentally, the question is, how do we deal with that CO2? How do we get it from where we're producing it, which is basically a power plant, to a geological, most likely a geological storage formation in the ground?
Yes, and I mean, again, Klaus pointed very rightfully out a lot of these things are essentially issues of size. You cannot get rid of a infrastructure that you've built up over literally 100 years and hope to do that overnight. So in that sense, dealing with CO2 is not a cop-out or an attempt to slow down the use of things like renewable energies or hydrogen. It is really a necessity. And then the other thing is, I also would like to point out that the CO2 capture that we're going to talk about does not just apply to power plants. There are a lot of other applications where we will see the chance to capture CO2 and have a very immediate impact in the CO2 balance in the atmosphere.
Yeah, so basically, as Rainer pointed out correctly, we're looking at CO2 that's being produced from power plants, industrial facilities, cement plants. There's a lot of sources of CO2, and there's a lot of opportunities to get rid of that, remove that CO2. But at the end of the day, you're going to end up with something that's very close to a pure CO2 or even a pure CO2 that you then need to transport to wherever you can stick it in the ground, let's call it that. And those tend to be geological formations. There are salt domes, there's depleted oil and gas reservoirs. There's other facilities that have plenty of storage capacity in many places of the world, including the United States, and many places where you can actually put the CO2. And it is reasonably safe to assume that it's going to stay underground for a long time. But we're not geologists, so we focus on the getting it into the ground. So then you're really looking at, okay, you are getting CO2. This CO2 can come in various pressures. And this is important from a machinery perspective, right? So it could be what we call pre-combustion carbon separation, which basically means you're making hydrogen and you're getting carbon dioxide, and then you're transporting that carbon dioxide. That means you're getting that CO2 at some pressure, elevated pressure, medium level, say. There could also be what's called a flue gas cleanup, which is basically post-combustion separation, where you're getting that CO2 at much, much lower pressures. In either case, you need to now take that CO2, transport it, get it into a pipeline. That pipeline is most likely going to run at a very high pressure at about 2100 PSI, but there are also opportunities to run at lower pressures at around 600, 700 PSI if you use an existing pipeline. Then you need to transport along the pipeline, which means you'd have to recompress it or repump it. And then finally, once you get to your geological formation, whatever the injection pressure is of that geological formation, you need it to get it into the ground to that pressure. So if that pressure is, let's say, 3,500, 4,000 PSI, then you need to get the CO2 to that pressure. So that kind of forms the background of the discussion. And CO2 is really not from the thermodynamic perspective, a difficult gas to compress. It's a very heavy gas. It's relatively easy to compress, but it does have a couple of technical challenges, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more.
Yeah, and just to emphasize a few things, in many instances, that CO2 that we're talking about will be available at relatively low pressure, probably close to atmospheric or maybe twice atmospheric pressure. So the compression task is actually quite sizable. The other thing is that because of that low pressure availability, you will also see most applications will require very high volumetric flows, which also excludes certain types of machineries really from being used there consistently. And lastly, a lot of the things that we're talking about are not, this is not some futuristic approach. There are already CO2 pipelines. There is already CO2 sequestration into the ground. There is already approaches to capture CO2 from flue gas or from fuel treatment.
Okay, so I my first question was going to kind of lay the groundwork for pumping CO2. And if you guys could explain the process, it sounds like you kind of touched on it already, but maybe go into a little bit more detail.
So from a compression perspective, CO2, because it is a heavy gas, it's not all that difficult to compress. Basically, you get for a centrifugal compressor, you get a very high pressure ratio per stage, which means was relatively few stages, you can make those very high pressure ratios that Rainer mentioned, going from basically atmospheric to maybe 2,000 PSI and then into a geological formation, which may even be higher. But a centrifugal compressor running at reasonable speed, so fairly conventional machines can accomplish that. Now, there are some technical challenges that are unique for CO2. So from a thermodynamic basic perspective, it's not that challenging. Some of the perspective problems are that when you have CO2, you start basically with a gas, and then you go into a dense phase fluid. That dense phase fluid could either be a liquid or it could be what's called a supercritical fluid. But in either case, you're going into something that behaves a little bit like liquid in that it is not very compressible as a fluid anymore. And so during that transition, there's also fairly drastic physical property changes, such as specific heat, such as speed of sound, such as density, that make the compressor design a little bit challenging. Once you're in this dense phase, then you can call it pumping, you can call it compression. It's basically the same thing because you're not changing compressibility anymore. I mean, it does physically the same thing. Although there is clearly, from a design perspective, there is differences between what we call a pump and a compressor. So that's kind of the challenge. There's a couple other things we can still talk about, which has to do with dry ice formation, which has to do with carbonic acid, and so on. We'll talk about that in a little bit later.
To Klaus's point, in that dense phase area, there's actually quite a few discussions about the machines that you're using. There are these pumps or compressors, because the reality is there is some, even though relatively small, compressibility, so it's not entirely a pump, and certainly compressors in their design can do this task relatively easily. we came up at a conference with a conclusion that if the machine is built by a pump manufacturer, it's a pump. If the machine is built by a compressor manufacturer, it's a compressor. it's really as clear as that.
Yeah. I mean, there are some from a design perspective, typically pumps tend to run at the same speed as an electric motor. So they tend to run slower and therefore you need more stages. They also have a hard time running what's called dry, not wet, meaning that you have startup issues with them. The construction generally is a little bit cheaper than the construction of a compressor. And so there is differences. There's also price difference between a pump and a compressor, but Rainer is absolutely right. If you go to a company that makes a pump and they sell you something CO2 in the supercritical or dense phase range, then they call it a pump. And we will call it a compressor. And it does exactly the same thing. It gets the fluid from a pressure from point A to a pressure at point B at a certain volume flow, which is a pump does, which was what a compressor does. The other challenging issues, and I kind of briefly mentioned that before, is that CO2 does, in any kind of presence of moisture, water, form carbonic acid, which makes the metallurgical design of a compressor or a pump a little bit challenging. You need to worry about coatings. It does also expand and can easily form dry ice at its dynamic or static seals. And so that's another thing. And so there's a number of other issues one need to worry about. But overall, as Rainer previously said, we've built CO2 compressors for a long time, and they work absolutely fine. It's just now we're talking about building massive quantities of CO2 compressors if we have to do all this decarbonization of our economy.
Yeah, I just want to point out two things on CO2 compression. One of the things is in that area, in the dense phase area above the critical pressure and temperature, actually behavior of CO2 is very sensitive to all the other stuff that may be in the CO2. So a little bit of other gases in the CO2 change the position of the pressure, critical pressure and temperature significantly. So that has to be considered when machines are sized and designed. The other thing is at these moderate pressures that Klaus also mentioned, when you want to transport CO2, not in the supercritical or dense phase area, but at lower pressures because you want to reuse existing pipelines, the pressure limit then will often not be the pressure rating of the pipeline, but simply the pressure at which you can avoid liquid CO2 dropouts at ambient temperatures or at ground temperatures for the pipeline. So there are some really interesting limitations that you will see there.
Yeah, and that brings up an interesting philosophical debate because basically the options are to transport the CO2 at a subcritical, you want pressure of 600 to 1,000 PSI, which allows you to use conventional pipeline technology, not high pressure pipelines, which allows you to probably forego most of the dehumidification because you don't have to worry about too much of the formation and carbonic acid, although it will also form, but it's not quite as much of an issue at lower pressures. It makes the entire process simpler, but it does limit you in the amount of volume flow that you can get through a given size pipeline. And it also usually will require more horsepower for a given amount of mass flow that you're trying to pump through the pipeline. And so on the one side, the opportunities are to use existing pipelines, at which point it would be purely a compression process, or most likely for longer distance, what will be done is use these supercritical pipelines that operate at very high pressures. And again, that's most likely going to be for pipelines that are more in the 200 miles or longer kind of range. If you're just going to go 20, 30, 40 miles, there's really no reason to go this high pressure, unless obviously your geological formation pressure is also very high at that point. You're going to need that pressure rise anyway. But those are some of the things that are being debated in the industry. There's other things that are being debated, like what is the best compressor, the centrifugal, recip, screw compressor, and those kind of things. Those are other issues where our industry is not quite at a consensus yet. And that's understandable because it's a relatively new opening market for these compressors.
Okay, so I was going to switch gears and talk about hydrogen, but based on some of the comments you guys just made, I think I'll ask, why is it so important to know about the supercritical state of CO2, and what are the differences between supercritical CO2 and CO2?
Imagine like you're talking about any fluid, water or whatever. Water can be solid, water can be gas. Water can be solid. And so that's basically what we're looking at here. The supercritical state, and let's start calling it the dense phase. That means it's at a state where there is a reduced amount of compressibility. So as you're putting work in, as you're increasing the pressure, the density of the fluid doesn't change that drastically anymore. That's called the dense phase. And in the dense phase, you have really two states. One is the liquid phase, which is very similar to liquid water, and the other one is called the supercritical phase. The only fundamental difference the supercritical fluid does is it acts in a volume similar to a gas that it fills the volume, whereas the liquid kind of drops to the bottom and swivels around like a liquid.
Part of the reason, the attraction of talking about supercritical states is because it sounds cool. But, thermodynamics is sometimes not necessarily the most exciting science. But the reality is when you're above the critical pressure and temperature of any gas, so this is not just the CO2 thing, then essentially you can cool that fluid without having a phase change. The specific thing about CO2 is that the supercritical pressure and temperature is well within the range that we normally deal with gases. So it's not at extremely high pressures or extremely low temperatures. It's well within the working range where we can build pipelines and where we can build compressors.
And again, it's not magic. Right. I mean, supercritical CO2, we've been dealing with that for a long, long time. Compressing a gas to 1200 psi or higher is not challenging given modern compression technology. And supercritical CO2 and its behavior is well known. That doesn't mean that all its physical properties are extremely well characterized when you get to very high temperatures and very high pressures. But most of the CO2 behavior in the operating range that we're talking about, which is basically from atmospheric to maximum 3,000 or so PSI, is well understood.
Okay, so now I'll go ahead and switch to the hydrogen discussion. Where does CO2 enter the hydrogen discussion?
Well, it's actually, there are a number of different ways of making hydrogen. Hydrogen is not a primary energy source. You have to make it. There is, of course, what's usually referred to as green hydrogen, where you use electricity from renewable sources. But there's also something called blue hydrogen, which is basically where you take natural gas, for example, and use separation processes where you then generate hydrogen and CO2. So that CO2 is then one of the byproducts of your method of making hydrogen from natural gas. And in the power generation discussion, what you will see is that there are really two fundamental ways of capturing CO2 if you want to continue using fossil fuels. The first one is you take the CO2 out before you feed your fuel into the gas turbine or other engines, and essentially use the hydrogen as a fuel and the CO2 as a byproduct. Or you run the machine with natural gas, and then you capture the CO2 in the exhaust in the flue of the machine. Klaus.
Yeah, and most of these technologies have advantage and disadvantage. The nice thing is if you do what Rainer mentioned first, which is called pre-combustion separation, basically it is you take whatever your fuel, you gasify it or run it through a steam reformer that gives you what's called a synthesis gas, which is carbon monoxide, hydrogen, and some other stuff. You take out the other stuff, you convert your CO2 through what's called a water shift reaction to CO2. Then you separate it using either physical or membrane or amine process And basically end up with hydrogen that you can then utilize in your industrial process or in your power generation or for whatever you have a usage for hydrogen. And by the way, hydrogen is a very valuable product in the industry. So it's useful in many applications such as refinery, petrochemicals. So it's not necessarily something that you always want to run in power generation. But regardless, that way you end up with CO2 at an elevated pressure, which is very nice. So that's the advantage of that process. The second process that Rainer mentioned is basically post-combustion separation, also called flue gas cleanup. The big disadvantage of that process is that the CO2 is at a relatively low concentration in the exhaust gas of your power plant, because I mean, very little CO2 is created in the combustion process. So that may be at, 1, 2, 3% at the exhaust of your power plant. Now, there are technologies called, for example, exhaust gas recirculations, where you can increase that CO2 content to something like 10 or 15% even, and that makes it easier to separate the CO2 out. As in other things, there is a huge debate going on in the industry as to what's better, pre-combustion separation, flue gas separation. I don't really have the answer. The numbers that I've seen recently indicate that for the conversion of a conventional power plant, so not if you build a brand new plant, but for a conversion of a conventional existing power plant, be it either a natural gas combined cycle plant or be it a pulverized coal type plant, for those, flue gas cleanup seems to be the more economic solution. If you start with a greenfield design and build a plant from scratch, the jury's still kind of sort of out on that one. It could be either way. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yeah, and as Klaus pointed out, part of it is our really essentially efficiency and energy consideration. And that is indeed one of the questions: how much energy consumption do you have for capturing CO2 and then recompressing it in the various different methods. Now, just to make one thing very clear, regardless of whether you get the CO2 from a pre-combustion process or from a post-combustion capture, the CO2 will usually show up at very low pressure, somewhere around atmospheric pressure.
In either case, you're going to need compression to get it into a pipeline and then recompress it if you compress it for pump, transport it for larger distances, and then compression again to get it into the ground. Just kind of sort of as a number, for roughly each pound of hydrogen that's being produced, let's say if you use steam reforming process where you take natural gas and you take out the hydrogen basically and you leave yourself with the CO2 as a byproduct, for each pound, roughly 10 pounds of CO2 are being produced that you then need to deal with. If you use a gasification process, it's a little less. It's only about 6, and I say only, it's still a big number, but 6 or 7 pounds of CO2 is being produced. So in that sense, the gasification process is a little more energy intensive, but the gasification process also requires significantly more infrastructure than a steam reforming process. And then the easiest is basically the flue gas cleanup, but then you're dealing with very, very large volume of gas that you have to basically run through a separation process to get the CO2 out. So all have advantages, all have disadvantages, all require significant additional capital at the power plant level, at the CO2 transport level, and at the CO2 reinjection level, and all of them require energy. So remember that your basic function of a power plant is to make power, and now you're taking some of that power to do all this other stuff that it's not originally intended to. So when people say, oh, we're all excited about CO2 separation, sequestration, hydrogen, and all that kind of stuff, just please remember that all this stuff costs a lot of money that has to be added to your ratepayer bill. The electricity consumer is eventually going to be the person that pays for this, both from the perspective of that these facilities have to be built and that a certain amount of energy that originally was intended to go into the transmission line is now going to be used for compression and other processes to make this carbon dioxide.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you both for joining me today and going over the CO2 pumping and compressing.
Thank you for having us. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, I really had fun. Thank you.
All right, and thank you to our audience for tuning in today. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, and we will see you next time.